It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Popular Science magazine has revealed the solution for the age-old problem of beer lovers. That is, how to have an ice-cold brew when you forgot to chill the six-pack. Well, genius techies have been working nights on this one. It's a new fridge by LG with this compartment. You put your can in it, it's blasted with cold air, and in minutes, you've got chilled beer. But that's not all. There's a motor that rocks the can, so, heaven forbid, ice crystals can't form. And this can be all yours for a mere $3,500. Of course, then you have no money left to buy the beer. Stick around. We've got lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, there is this new condiment I'll bet you have not tried. It's got New York food pros improvising with it like mad. It's an off-the-wall take on mayonnaise. David Leet of leetsculinaria.com is the man who introduced them to this marvel. And David joins us from New York. David, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Lynn. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So explain this mayonnaise.
Well, it's an interesting thing. It's not a real mayonnaise, it's air bunny mayonnaise.
And what air bunny?
Air bunny mayonnaise. And what I mean by that is there's no egg in it. It's actually an emulsion of oil and milk, and that's what makes the luscious, light base that you can add many things to it. And what's happened is a lot of people who have egg allergies have latched onto this and made it their own. And it's quite an interesting condiment.
What goes through my mind is the concerns over contamination in eggs. You've just sidestepped it completely.
100%.
But a milk mayonnaise. Okay, so how do you do this?
Okay.
How does it work?
Well, to make this air bunny mayonnaise, and I want to be very clear that it's not a true mayonnaise, is you take very cold milk and you then add some lemon juice to it, a little bit of garlic and some white pepper, and then you use a hand blender or a mini chop. You can't do this in a food processor or a very large blender because the amount, the volume is too small.
Uh-huh.
And then you start just whizzing in some oil. And I use vegetable oil. And it just very slowly in the beginning, just like you do with mayonnaise. And
like a few drops at a time.
Exactly.
Right?
And then you have a thin thread, which is called a fio in Portuguese. And then it gets a little bit thicker, what you're pouring in. And then all of a sudden, this mixture, which is very liquidy, just all of a sudden magically turns luscious and thick and light and whipped. Almost, it's the texture of mayonnaise, a light homemade mayonnaise.
This sounds incredible. Now, is this from Portugal?
It is from Portugal. That's where I got it. I was actually on the hunt for different recipes for my cookbook, The New Portuguese Table, and we were going through the Alentejo region, which is the sort of the middle swath of the country, and there was a restaurant we went to called A Bolota, and there was on the table this incredible green olive dip. And before anyone had a chance, I ate all of it. I just thought it was fantastic. So I asked the chef, Ilda Vinagra, I said, what is it? And she explained what it was. And then she said, it's made with a milk mayonnaise. And I thought, oh, that's a mistake, milk mayonnaise. So after dinner, she took me in the kitchen. And, of course, she was making this volumes and volumes of this milk mayonnaise and showing me exactly how to do it. And that's where I got it. And, of course, as these things happen, I brought it back to America and I tried to make it and I failed time after time after time. And then finally when I got back to her, she got back to me and I asked her what the problem was. It was because I was making it in the food processor. She said for the small volume I was making, it couldn't be done.
Ah.
And when I used my hand blender or my mini chop, boom, there it was.
Because the container you're actually doing it in is smaller.
Exactly. So what I do is I use a 2-cup glass measuring cup and that's what I make it in. And it works every single time.
I'll be darned. So, okay, so ice-cold milk.
Mm-hmm.
Does the oil have to be cold?
No, not at all. Just for whatever reason, the milk works better when it's cold.
Okay.
And the lemon juice, and a little bit of garlic and white pepper are all mixed together, and then the vegetable oil is what's poured in, and a little bit of salt in the end.
Okay, so now to make this fabulous olive dip that you scarfed up, how do you do that?
Well, you have chopped up green olives, like a manzanilla olives or a Spanish olive, and you take that, and then once you're done, and there's also cilantro that you would then put in that base too, a bunch of cilantro and some anchovy.
Ooh, I like
it. And then you make that base, and then you'll stir in the olives, and then you serve it right then and there. Now, you've got to be careful if you're going to do that, that you don't make it ahead of time by putting the olives into the base. Because of the brine of the olives, it coagulates the base too much. So I just mix it in at the last minute.
Can you use other oils like olive oil or walnut oil or
absolutely,
you know, canola oil or whatever?
People have written me and told me they've used safflower oil, they've used grapeseed oil, they've used soybean oil, canola oil, olive oil. Now, I don't like too much olive oil. I prefer just a little bit if I'm going to use it because it gets too strong for me. People have used all kinds of olive oil and really all kinds of milk. I've heard people say they've made it with skim milk, with 2% milk, with soy milk, almond milk. And I've not made any of them, but I've heard great success from these people. And I think what's most interesting to me is how they're flavoring them. That's what blows my mind. Is, for instance, David Leibovitz out there in Paris, he used chervil and made a chervil milk mayonnaise.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard of a garlic milk mayonnaise, like an aioli. People have made ginger, a rosemary, a tarragon, sriracha.
Sriracha.
I know, And someone put in balsamic vinegar. Someone made a Dijon version. And they're using it for, I get all these emails. Someone's using it for potato salad. Someone's using it as a spread for bread. Someone's using it as a topping for steak or for chicken or for fish.
Yeah. David, brilliant. Thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
David Leite is the creator of LeitesCulinaria.com and author of The New Portuguese Table. Now, you can find his milk mayonnaise and green olive dip on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our podcasts, including chef interviews from our Key 3 series, dig into the recipe box, and take a look at our special summer booklet, A Summertime Grilling Guide. It's a collection of great recipes for really easy summer eating. Everything is poised and waiting for you right there at splendidtable.org. You know, when I'm on the road, it drives me crazy to realize I settled for a mediocre meal when the next town had a gem of a cafe. This is why you check with roadfood.com, Jane and Michael Stern's site, and hear their finds here every week. Hey, Jane, Michael, good to have you back, guys.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So where have you been traveling?
Oh, this is just the weirdest place we're going to tell you about. We've been in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
But not just the Upper Peninsula, the uppermost part of the Upper Peninsula of
Michigan. Well, we never do anything halfway.
As far north as you can go.
And we found a restaurant that's not really a restaurant. You eat outside, and their specialty is liquor-soaked cake and jam made from at a local monastery.
All right, now wait a minute.
Back up a little.
And jam made at a local monastery by inebriated monks, by any chance?
Well,
is there a crossover here?
No, the monks run the place. The Society of St. John actually operates the jam pot. And I have to tell you, I mean, even before you get to the food, just approaching this place, I mean, it's really like a fairy tale. It's surrounded by, you know, those beautiful woods of the Upper Peninsula. I mean, it's just gorgeous countryside. And it's this little hut in the middle of the woods. And as soon as you open your car door, you smell not just baking things, which is good enough, you know, by itself, but baking things, as Jane said, soaked with liquor.
Like Jamaican black cake soaked in rum or wine.
Oh, my. So is it a bakery or a restaurant?
No, it is a bakery. It is a bakery and a jam and jelly making operation.
And hut. It sort of looks like something that would be in Harry Potter, where, like, trolls lived.
And as Jane said, there's no place to eat there. But the fact is, you know, if you're driving around this part of the Upper Peninsula, there are plenty of places to pull off the road and, you know, gaze out at some of the most beautiful lakes and forests there are in
Lake
this nation.
Medora.
Lake Medora is very nearby. And you know, we happened to be there in the fall when we first went up there. And, you know, the autumn in the Upper Peninsula is as beautiful as anywhere in the country.
And that's said by Connecticut Yankees who think we have all the good leaves. But in the, in the Upper Peninsula, I mean, in the autumn, it just will blow you away. And if you're eating rum-soaked Jamaican black cake, you will...
It's even better.
Even better. It's one of those places where after you drive away, you think, did I dream this? You know, I mean, there's just something... The whole atmosphere of the place, the whole geographical splendor of it, the strange little bakery, there's something very dreamlike about it. I don't know, Michael, maybe we did just dream it.
No, it exists.
It exists. Okay. Hey, thank you, guys.
Bye. Jane and Michael Stern are the minds and the palates behind roadfood.com. Now, find their latest discoveries at splendidtable.org. You know, you can't think of Michigan this time of year and not dream of cherries. Now, when you're buying the fruit, to have an edge of getting a lot of flavor for the money, you should know your cherry's name. There are a lot of types of cherries. Some are brilliant, some are blah. For instance, the Bing, found everywhere, is sweet enough, but it's not earth-shaking. On the other hand, the Rainier and the Royal Rainier, these are a little harder to find, but they can be transcendental. They're so delicious. Now, in that same elusive category are the Royal Eddies and the Royal Helens from California. And just behind these in goodness are the Queen Annes, the Lappins, the Lamberts, and the Bentons. Now, if you run across any of them, taste before buying, but don't ignore them. Look, we've got another month, and then they're going to be gone until next year. I'm going to put my short list of cherry picks on the website, along with some ideas for using them. It's all, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with our latest Key 3 chef, Sally Schneider, and her three recipes that you've got to master. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Sally Schneider is one of those people who everything she does is about possibilities, be it with food or space or life. And to see what I mean, take a look at her improvisedlife.com site. Now, Sally's been a regular on our show for a long time because she always sees things through a different prism. And this is why she's our latest Key 3 star cook. We visited her home kitchen in New York for a firsthand lesson in her Key 3 picks, the three recipes she thinks everyone should have in their arsenal. Now, you have to imagine Sally. She's slight. She has this massive dark hair, kind of a quiet way about her. Her apartment's modest and airy, and it has a comfortable spareness. It's also her design lab where she experiments with found things. So you notice her kitchen island, well, it has the surface of an antique Paris bar. It's covered with this pewter-like metal. Well, it turns out it's an old sheet of zinc that she used to cover the countertop that she didn't like. Well, that's where we started to talk food. Sally, it's great to be here in your apartment.
Lynn, I am completely thrilled to have you here and see you again.
Okay, now you chose which recipes is your Key 3?
After much consideration, yes. Actually after very little consideration, I chose an herb salt, specifically a Tuscan herb salt, but It has lots of ways you can improvise with it, a roast chicken, foolproof roast chicken, and a really beautiful French-style chocolate cake.
Why these particular recipes?
The herb salt, because it is the one preparation that I find myself using the most. And I figure if I'm using it all the time, it's going to be good for other people.
Okay.
And I found it to be a great thing to to pass on to people. And the roast chicken and the cake, because my boyfriend learned to cook when he met me. And he said when he was able to make a roast chicken, he felt completely empowered because he could serve it at a dinner party and know that he had made one of the world's most classic dishes perfectly. The chocolate cake, because everybody should know how to make a really perfect chocolate cake. And most people I know are terrified of making a cake, period. So I thought, let me take a look at chocolate cakes and see if I can come up with a recipe that is, again, foolproof, because succeeding in these things and having them be easy allows us to do them frequently. And also I wanted a cake that you could improvise with, that you could take it somewhere and make it your own.
And not screw up.
And not, yeah, and still have it be a success.
Right. Okay, so what do you want to show me here?
I think the best thing to show is the herb salt, because it's fast and easy, endlessly useful. And there's a lot of ways to play with it. And you can see that right now. There's also big lessons in the herb salt.
Okay. All right. So we've got a cutting board. We're at your counter. You've got a pile of herbs. You've got bundles of garlic. And you've taken a clove of garlic that has the skin, and you're crushing it with the side of a knife.
Just to be able to pull the skin off easily.
Right.
What I am going to do is make sure to see, there's a little sprout.
Oh, the green sprout in the center.
Yes. Now, this is great garlic. It's from a farmer friend of mine. But it's winter. There's no way there isn't going to be a little sprout happening.
And why do you take out the sprout?
I take it out because it can be a bit bitter. So I've got the garlic. I use kosher salt for this. You could use sea salt. But I love kosher salt because it's a uniform texture. And it's not really strong, so it allows the flavors to come through more. I'm not going to stand the chance of oversalting something when I use this.
So you're chopping now, just chopping the garlic with the salt.
I'm chopping the garlic with the salt. Now, I'm going to be adding herbs into this, but what you're seeing here is actually me making garlic salt. That's the first step.
Okay, but we're always told that we're not supposed to store garlic. You know, we're not supposed to put garlic in oil and keep it. We're not supposed to, you know, that it can develop botulism. What
right.
about this mixture?
Salt is a preservative, and it's in the open air. If I leave this out overnight, by morning it will be completely dried out. The garlic, in effect, will be preserved.
So now you've got branches of sage, you've got rosemary branches, you've just stripped the leaves off the rosemary. How much are you using? You've got, about a tablespoon or so, a tablespoon and a half of salt, a couple of cloves of garlic that you've minced.
Yes, and these are all variables that you can determine. I tend to go with very low amount of salt if I can, because I want to pack in the flavor of the herbs. So my rough formula is about a tablespoon of salt, about a half a cup of herbs, and one or two cloves of garlic.
Sage and rosemary are a classic combination in much of Italy, but you associate them with Tuscany, don't you?
I do, although I know that this is used in Bologna as
and in Lombardia. This is all northern Italy that we're talking about. And
right.
There's a commonality, but personally, for me, I was raised in a household. My mother's family's Tuscan. I was raised with these flavors, this combination.
You know,
so it's evocative.
They're perfect, though. They go with everything. What will happen with this, Lynn, is, first of all, I can put this right away on a roast chicken or a roast pork or whatever. If I leave this out, if I just spread it out on a sheet pan or whatever, it will dry, which is what I did last night, and the whole apartment smelled like these herbs.
Oh, here it is.
This is it dry. And you discover that these flavors go wonderfully with eggs. When I fry eggs, I throw it in. Vegetables like carrots or roasted onions or whatever, or peppers. I use this herb salt instead of salt, basically. And the lesson in it that I love is that salt is really a carrier of flavor. It will wick the flavors into the food and infuse them with the flavor.
This is the thing, the step that I think has been missing with other recipes for herb salt. And that step is spread it out and let it dry overnight.
And then you have a trove that you can call on whenever you need it. So
yeah,
when I'm really working hard, I'm using this all the time. Now, we've done this with sage and rosemary. We've got a wealth of possibilities we can do with this. I bought some, if you take the rosemary and put it with thyme and some of the lavender that I dried this summer.
Right.
And if I had some savory, I would have a classic herb de Provence, which are the herbs that grow all over Provence in France.
And you spend a great deal of money to buying those in a little container.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So if I did that mix with some salt, I would have an herb de Provence salt, and I could use it the way my brilliant friend Ellen Silverman used it in my chocolate cake. She decided to replace the salt in the cake with an herb de Provence salt, and it had no garlic in it. It was just the herb. It was sensational and a complete surprise, these little kind of undertones of herbs backing up the chocolate, which was fabulous. So I was thinking about that, and last night I thought, how would this stuff be on butter cookies? So I whipped up a batch of this really simple butter cookie dough, which is all butter,
right,
practically.
Right.
And I tried it. I made the herbs of Provence salt, and I put it on. It was a complete experiment.
Right.
I thought, you know, even if it doesn't work, it's a good example of trying something, seeing what happens.
And you're all about improvising.
I am.
Right?
I am, and getting information from it. So there are the cookies.
Can I
right?
taste?
Yeah.
Okay.
I ate three of them last night, actually.
Ooh. The salt sets off the sweet and the butter, and you get a hint of the herb. The only thing I would like is even more herb.
Well, see, that was my question. I started low, testing it out, because I thought, I don't know the parameters here.
Yeah, and I would do the same thing. I think, I just wonder that in this case, oh, wait a minute, now hold on. I just got the aftertaste.
A message is coming in.
A message is, I just got, the rosemary just arrived.
So maybe what I needed
to do. But
boy,
is this a great idea.
Is make the balance of herb to salt bigger. The other thing that could go into it is some Meyer lemon zest or something like that.
So you can take this salt and
take
it.
It can go forever in improvising.
Sally, great stuff. Thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook and creator of the Improvised Life website. Now, to watch some video of Sally and her herb salts and listen to the rest of our conversation about her key three picks, go to splendidtable.org. You'll also find her three key recipes for those salts, her basic roast chicken and its many improvs, and her chocolate cake that can morph into so many desserts. Everything's on the website, splendidtable.org. Tis the season of the traveler's friend, the guidebook. Now, Doug Mack is a writer who picked up an old guidebook at a book sale. Europe on $5 a Day by Arthur Frommer, published in 1963. Well, he took it home and discovered Europe on $5 a Day was the travel Bible his mother used on her unforgettable first trip abroad. That was in 1967. The guide and his mom's wide-eyed adventures with it sparked an idea, which became Doug's book, Europe on 5 Wrong Turns a Day. Doug, it's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what got to you about this guide, Europe on $5 a Day?
Well, at first I was just interested in sort of the family history angle. You know, this is a book that my mother had used. But as I started paging through the book and looking through my mom's own letters and postcards, I thought, you know, this is a really interesting snapshot of life and travel in a very different era. And I was just amazed by how much things had changed, or in some cases hadn't changed, in just a generation.
So what did you do about it? You were curious, but what happened?
So I decided to go to Europe using only this 1963 guidebook and my mom's letters and no internet research, no modern guidebooks, nothing else, and to sort of reclaim that sense of wide-eyed innocence and to try to become a 1960s traveler in my own way with the limited information that was available back then.
So what happened?
Well, I got lost a lot. many of the hotels and restaurants and things were closed. But in each city, I found a handful that were still open. And so I had these magical moments of discovery and finding, wow, this isn't just some boarded up building. There's an actual place here. And it's exactly, in many cases, it's exactly as Arthur Frommer described it. And that was great.
Like 40 years earlier.
Oh, absolutely. There were some places. There was a cafeteria in Rome that fit Frommer's description to a T. It was like stepping into a time warp. It was fantastic.
What did they serve? What was it like?
Oh, it was just sort of working class Italian food, and you would order at the counter. And there weren't a lot of other tourists there. You know, if it ever had its tourist heyday, that has since passed by. And so now it's just kind of a quiet locals place that I happened to discover with my old guidebook. It was lovely.
Was there a food experience from Frommer that you then followed up 40 years later that surprised you?
Yeah, absolutely. There are several of them, but the most notable one was in Madrid, a place called Casa Botín. And Frommer describes it in my guidebook, and he says that it's a place that's mentioned in Ernest Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises, but the restaurant doesn't really mention that, and it's very discreet, and he's surprised by that. He's surprised that they weren't exploiting the Hemingway connection even back then, and he says that probably won't last. But the reason you go there, to Frommer's view, is that you sample this food, which is sort of the traditional Spanish food. And there's this thing called cuchinillos, which is a roasted pork dish, which is he describes as just really delicious. So I went there. And, of course, the Hemingway connection is exploited to the full extent now. There's a big painting of him in the window, and they absolutely market it to the tourists. But what was wonderful to me was that the food was still absolutely magnificent. And they have this oven that they've been using since the 1700s, and that's still where they cook their pork. And it also holds the distinction from Guinness Book of World Records as the world's oldest restaurant.
Really?
Yeah, there's a certificate in the window in addition to the Hemingway painting. So to my mind, even though lots of other tourists are there and have been there, it's still wonderful. I can experience this thing in my own way. And all of the rest of the world, all of the trappings of the tourist stuff, all of the Hemingway stuff, all of that falls away. And suddenly it's just you and this plate of food, or sometimes it's a work of art or something like that. And it doesn't matter that it's famous. That is inconsequential. It just matters that it speaks to you in some really intangible way that I hate to use the word soul-stirring, because that almost seems like a cliche, but I think that it's true. There are these moments and these times when you get to this thing. I have felt the same way about the David statue in Florence, where you hear about it and you hear about it, but then you get there and it's just magical. And there's nothing like being in the presence of the actual thing and experiencing it for yourself.
And then maybe that's what Frommer was going for.
Absolutely. I think that is what Frommer was going for, is that you need to go see these things on your own.
Have you heard from him?
I haven't heard from him directly, but we happened to be back-to-back guests on a radio show a few weeks ago, and I was terrified about what he was going to say, because I was on first, and I knew that he would be listening the whole time.
Uh-huh.
And I was nervous because, here's this book that I've written about this guy. And I actually didn't listen to it live myself because I was so nervous, but my mother was sending me text updates the whole time. But I need not have been nervous, because it turned out that he loved it. And he was overjoyed that I had sort of talked about his legacy and how he had influenced travel and how he had really sort of opened it up for the masses. And I have a lot of respect for him. And that's exactly the story that I wanted to tell with my book.
Doug, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Doug Mack is author of Europe on 5 Wrong Turns a Day. You know, if you're into cocktails, the fresh and inventive new style cocktails, you're probably drinking something that Shakespeare sipped. I'm talking about verjus.
It's a liquid that disappeared for centuries and now is back big time with bartenders and in chefs' kitchens. Now, the man leading the pack and producing it is California winemaker and owner of Bonnie Doon Vineyard, Randall Graham. He makes Verjus de Cigar. Randall, it's good to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much.
So, can you explain what Verjus is?
Verjus is literally green juice, and it's grape juice that's harvested from immature grapes, and it's exceptionally tart and not so sweet, and it's brilliant in so many ways.
Brilliant in what ways?
Well, for one thing, it's a lovely salvage operation for something that one's going to do in the vineyard anyways. When you thin your vineyard, instead of dropping the fruit on the ground, you harvest it instead and use it in cooking, as a condiment, as a cocktail, in a lot of ways, in fact. It's a really lovely, elegant application of what would otherwise be something you would do out of necessity.
I understand, though, that we have not made Verjus in this country very much because our techniques for growing grapes are different than the Europeans. Do I have that right?
Well, I mean, basically, we grow grapes the same way. Grapes grow the way they do all over the world. But Europeans, in many, many great appellations, are very fastidious about thinning their crops to get the intensity they need. And the reason they have to thin is often they're growing grapes in very marginal areas, and they really struggle to ripen. Whereas in California, our grapes generally don't have to struggle to do much of anything. So therefore, we haven't really been in the habit of thinning our grapes as much. And in the last few years, growers have gotten a lot more quality conscious, and it's not such an alien concept to actually thin your vineyard.
So the idea is that by thinning the vineyard, you're getting higher quality grapes and better quality wine. And then, so now they've got the green grapes to make the Verjus.
Exactly. I mean, still not everyone has flocked to the idea of making Verjus. It's kind of a pain in the neck.
Really?
Well, I mean, we don't see the world just all at once deciding to make Verjus. It's a little bit of a hassle, as I said. It occurs right during harvest, so bottling grape juice right before you're about to make wine is kind of a pain for some people. But it's worth it if you can pull it off. I mean, one of the issues with Verjus, the biggest issue from a production standpoint, is keeping it sterile and keeping the yeast out of it. If you get any yeast when you're making the Verjus, if you have any yeast in the bottle, you're going to have an explosive situation at some point. And so during harvest, there's lots of yeast floating around the winery, so it's a little bit perilous for some.
So how to use it? How do we use it?
Well, first of all, our Verjus, which we make from Grenache grapes, a red grape, is actually quite green because we've harvested it just as the bunches are about to turn color. It's still quite green, and ours is a little bit sweeter than traditional Verjus. Traditional Verjus is exceptionally tart, almost like a mild vinegar. So ours isn't quite that tart, and you can actually consume it on its own, although I think it's a little bit better when you mix it with sparkling water or light beer or something like that. You can use it certainly in salads. You can use it for reductions. It's any time you might use citrus, it would be a good substitute for citrus.
Oh, that's a great way of thinking of it. Yeah. I love the idea of making a spritzer with it. I mean, great.
Well, my 9-year-old daughter thinks it's one of the brilliant concoctions in the world.
Great. Now, what should we look for when we buy it?
Fresh Verjus. You don't want Verjus that's been hanging around for years, although likely you won't find old Verjus. It will have probably exploded by then. and of course, when you buy it, after you open it, it's fine. It's very stable. But once you open it, definitely put it in the fridge. That's something you really want to do, much as you would apple juice or orange juice after you open it.
Okay. Randall, thanks so much for talking with us.
My great pleasure.
Randall Graham has Bonnie Doon Vineyards and makes Verjus de Cigar. Now, this is made from the same grapes that go into his red Le Cigar Volant, also known as the Flying Cigar. Well, this week's trivia challenge is up. Now, the question is, what is the world's most expensive olive oil? Well, we'll be back with the answer and your calls
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or call us, 800-537-5252. But before we connect, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the world's most expensive olive oil? And the answer is golden olive oil. But that's not the color of the oil. It's the color of the big flakes of 24-karat gold floating in the oil. Golden olive oil comes from Croatia. Now, it arrives impressively packed in a beautiful glass bottle that is in a black velvet pouch locked in a black lacquer box, and it guarantees a sense of joy with every drop. Plus, you receive an ownership card that allows you the privilege of visiting the oil's source. It's the olive grove on the island of Hvar in Croatia, at your own expense, of course. Oh, and did I mention that the oil comes with a white cotton serving glove? And the price for all of this? For 1 cup of oil, that's the size of the bottle, plus all the falderol, you pay $939.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Heather's on the line from Amherst, Massachusetts. Heather, what is on your mind?
Well, Lynn, I can't think of a better person to help me with this menu. My good friends are coming from Italy, and I've had long, lovely, delicious meals in their home. And finally, it's our chance to host them. I love the rhythm and the leisure of an Italian meal with the antipasto, the primo, the secondi.
Right, right.
But they're not making their first trip to the United States to eat Italian food. So I want a menu that follows the shape and pace of an Italian meal, but is made with American foods and flavors.
Well, the secret behind an Italian meal is that you're really eating pieces of the meal that we normally put all together separately.
Yeah. Yeah.
The starch, the pasta, is served as a separate course. There may be a soup. You may feature a vegetable dish, right?
Yeah.
So think about what is local to you. It may be cheeses. It may be, you know, those clams. It may be wonderful pork or beef. Seafood, whatever it may be, think of that as perhaps not necessarily appearing as the segundo. I mean, it could, you know, as that in quotes, what we think of as the main dish. But you might want to parcel those kinds of things out through the whole meal. So you might begin with a platter of little tidbits made from vegetables. Okay, so you might have marinated green beans. Oh, my God, tomatoes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The vegetables will be great at this time of year.
The vegetables will be stunning. So one of the things that you could do is take fresh sweet corn and you could grill it for them, brush it with butter, and then for fun, just as being a little playful, roll it in Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese.
Ah.
And that can be a first course, or instead of the pasta, it's the primo, okay?
Uh-huh.
Before that, you might have little nibbles of things that you've done with vegetables, little things that you've marinated, that you've sautéed and you're serving at room temperature, that sort of thing, okay?
Yeah.
So you go to the market and, you know, I would cut green beans into 1-inch pieces, steam them lightly, and then toss them with little cubes
of bacon, really good farmhouse bacon,
yes.
You know, and serve that at room temperature with a sprinkling of cider vinegar on it.
Mm-mm-mm.
You know, put the cider vinegar on the last minute because otherwise the beans turn army green.
Yep.
But that's a little tastes of those kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
Then do the corn on the cob.
Yep.
Because that's the big feature. And say to them, you know, you're here from Italy, so I'm doing it with the cheese. But this is, you know, this is our classic, and often we eat it as a complete course unto itself. Then from there, take something like maybe a little bowl of steamer clams.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they're great or if you like them, you know.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, because they've probably never had them.
Uh-huh.
And you
really?
Know, classic way of eating them. And, you know, with the butter and the dipping and the whole thing and the broth that you eat up with a spoon and
mm-hmm.
you've got some bread, local bread, serve it with cornbread.
Oh.
Don't do the artisan
good.
Bread.
Okay.
Serve it with, you know, good New England cornbread.
Excellent.
And, yeah. And then from there, I think what you want to do is maybe a incredible thing with tomatoes, but something ridiculously simple. Like you may want to chop up some chili and have some fresh lime juice and then a little bit of oil and a tad of, believe it or not, a little bit of brown sugar
mm-hmm.
and heat that in the microwave for
oh.
about a minute and
uh-huh.
then have your tomatoes sliced and you could have all different kinds, either wedges or slices, of heirlooms.
Oh, yeah. I can get some beautiful ones.
And make sure you do the dark tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
Because I haven't seen those in Italy, and they're just luscious.
Mm.
And what you do is drizzle this over those tomatoes.
Okay.
Okay? And then for your main course, you might want to do barbecued chicken.
You do that. I could practice.
Yeah, but you know what the trick is?
What?
Cook it in the oven first and then heat it up on the grill.
Okay.
And do it a day ahead.
Okay.
And that's, you know, really, I'm not kidding. It works like a charm. Take it from a woman who served more raw chicken at the bone than you can shake a stick at. And
okay.
then from there, I would do something like wild blueberry pie and have a big salad. That's the other thing. You got to have a big salad with local greens. But
okay.
then I would do something like a local peach pie or a blueberry pie, something on that order.
Yeah.
And that's your American welcome
oh,
dinner.
Now that is a lovely menu.
Yeah, and that corn on the cob as the, in quotes, primo or pasta course mm-hmm. is going to, I think, knock them dead.
And I'm just going to spread this over however
leisurely
long it takes.
Take your time. There is
yeah.
no rush.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing you want to have hot and ready to go is the corn. Everything
mm-hmm.
else can be kind of waiting.
Yeah.
You
yep.
know, it's not a big deal. So take it slow and easy. And really, mm-hmm. you enjoy it.
And I am so going to enjoy this.
Have a great welcome dinner.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye now.
You can call us 800-537-5252 or check us out on the website. Just send us an email, splendidtable.org. Vajra is on the line from Seattle. Vajra, what do you want to talk about?
I am looking for an idea for my friend's wedding. I'm in charge of coming up with some sort of signature cocktail drink.
Aha. Okay.
Yes. And I've played around with some infused liquors last summer, and so I was thinking of doing something like that, but it has to be something that we can simply, you know, pour a few bottles of different things into a bowl and let people
serve
themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that I think is the most refreshing in a situation like that, especially, it's a summer wedding, I gather.
Yeah, it's August wedding.
All right. Well, you got a couple of choices. One of the things you can do is take a leaf from the Mexican agua frescas, which are essentially fruit juices, like purees of watermelon that you
mm-hmm.
strain and press out all the juices, or peaches, or anything like that. And it's sweetened to taste. And what I do with that kind of thing is I add rum to it. Or you could do infused rum where you do it with lemon and fresh ginger because it would work beautifully with almost any fruit.
Wow.
And yeah, and then you got that tart snap. And that goes into the big bowl with the agua fresca. And as I said, it can be peaches. Now, if it's something really sweet like peaches, then you want a fair amount of lemon in there. and you want to infuse that vodka with the ginger and lemon and then add fresh lemon juice because you don't want it sickly sweet.
Right.
And it's very light and fresh because usually the fruit is watered down a bit. It's put over ice. And then you can float in it slices of whatever the fruit is and the lemon and even slivers of ginger.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Yeah, I think you're going to be home free with that. And the nice thing about it is between the real punch of the ginger and the snap of the lemon, it's refreshing in August heat.
Yeah.
And it's still, and also you don't have to have people reeling from too much liquor.
Also good.
Yeah. You now have your signature wedding cocktail.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Take care.
Bye.
You know, think about that, by the way, these agua frescas from Mexico, which are so simple to do. It's simply you puree fruit with a bit of water. You can strain it or not strain it. And then what you do is you can almost make a concentrate and then you put it over ice and you add water to taste and you add sweetness to taste. They are so refreshing. And especially with spicy summer food, the perfect thing to drink. Perfect. John Schlimm throws a party in a book. He's that enthusiastic. Grill parties are his thing, and his food entices big time. Now, here's the sort of unexpected angle. His book is Grilling Vegan Style, not what you normally connect with partying at the grill. Hey, John, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you.
You know, vegan on the grill can be a real challenge. So how would you have us start?
Well, you know, I think that you're right. It is challenging and it's mysterious and it's even scary to some people. And my objective is to just blow through that stereotype because really it's just about removing animal products from the food. It's not about really not allowing yourself to eat a lot of things. In fact, it expands just what you can eat. And certainly you can put just about anything on the grill and it does not have to involve animal products.
So give me some ideas of what you like to do for main dishes.
Well, you know, I love doing veggie burgers on the grill. And I love to make veggie burgers from scratch, which are quite simple. I have the slip and sliders, which use garbanzo beans and green onions and toasted almonds and cumin and coriander. Of course, portobello burgers, there's not much mixing you need. You can just marinate them and put them right on the grill. And they act like a hearty burger. You can take things like cauliflower, which maybe on its own doesn't have much flavor, but you put it on the grill and you combine it with some smoked paprika, and it just has that wow factor.
But, you know, there are three things that sort of replace meat for vegans. It's tempeh and seitan and tofu. How do you handle these on the grill?
Well, you know, they can be a little temperamental, especially the tofu and the seitan. The tempeh is a little bit sturdier and stronger and hardier, so that holds up a little better. But there are these wonderful things called grill screens, which everyone should have. Even if they aren't vegans or vegetarians, it's just a great thing to have for making things like smaller vegetables or skinnier vegetables like asparagus. Sometimes the asparagus spear slipped through the grate. So a grill screen will take care of all that. But the other thing that you can do is put skewers in the tofu as well as the seitan, and that really helps to keep it above board.
Right. So how do you grill tofu?
Well, the way I grill it, you first have to really drain the water out of it, and which is quite simple. You just put it on a paper towel and put a weight on top, and that will drain. And I do that for about an hour because you don't want all that water spitting and splattering all over the grill. But then I love to marinate it, and that's really the miracle and the magic of those three what are called meat analogs, the tofu, tempeh, and seitan, is they act like these great sponges for any flavors you want to mix them with. So I will whip up a marinade that maybe is lemon and garlic or mustard and white wine. I have a classic barbecue sauce. Really, any of the marinades you would use with meat, you can use on these three. And especially the tofu really absorbs it. And then I put it on the grill screen. And the thing about grilling anything, really, is grills need a lot of attention. You need to sort of stand right beside them and watch the food the whole time. But these things grill up in about 8 to 10 minutes, turn them maybe once or twice until they're golden brown. And that's all it takes, and they're done.
That sounds fabulous.
John, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
John Schlimm is author of Grilling Vegan Style. Now, he's left us with a complete vegan party menu. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Keep in touch. You have a great one. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Paul Simon, who said, improvisation is too good to leave to chance. Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for more information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway and make a visit to our online store. And don't miss the newest issue of our quarterly ebook, Eating In with Lynn. It's the big summer party issue. You get a menu, recipes, tips, opinions, and cooking lessons. You're going to find all that information at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.